Polish USAID has been led by billionaire Elon Musk, who is advising Trump on his effort to shrink the federal government. And the Trump administration has started to send migrants to Guantanamo Bay despite questions about the plan's legality. Yesterday, a military flight carrying about 10 migrants with criminal records landed in Guantanamo, U.S. officials said. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. So I wanted to just do a little update here before we go on to our clip of the day. What is happening right now, of course, we had a demonstration yesterday to welcome Netanyahu, the war criminal, to the city, along with when he met with Trump. And of course, everybody was shocked that that Trump had said that the United States would like to take over Gaza now. And basically, he said it'll be make amazing oceanfront property. And of course, he's following his son-in-law's statement of many months ago. And I don't know why people are shocked at these things, as if Trump doesn't say shocking things or things that are off the cuff or things that he's never going to do. But obviously, as Daniel Levy had said, the Israeli commentator, who's been really spot on with his analysis, he said that basically that in the case, in what he was saying is that he was wondering why, if Trump did see any of these images that we've been seeing, these amazing images of Palestinians returning home in the hundreds of thousands, and also the joyous celebrations in the northern of Gaza as people reach there through the corridor that was basically built for the Israeli or for more a permanent occupation. And I just wanted to remind the listeners that there was an attempt basically to build a kind of an exit that was brought in by this floating bridge that was supposed to eventually evacuate Gazans, or somebody suspected that, and it was manned by the U.S. military, and it was a way for the U.S. military also to have a presence in Gaza. And of course, that failed after that the bridge sailed away, after millions of dollars had been spent on it. The, you know, it was brought in under the pretense of providing aid. You know, nothing defines symbiotic relationship between the two parties like what's happening, what we're seeing now. You know, Biden basically supplies all the weaponry and to destroy Gaza, as he lies about ceaselessly seeking a peace agreement. And then in comes Trump, and he basically says, okay, we've cleared Gaza, now we need to clear the people out of there and have our little Club Med, basically, there. This is what I mean when I talk to people and tell them that this is a situation what I call a volley and a spike. As you know, in volleyball, one person sets up the ball, the other person spikes it. The setup is called the volley, and then the spike is hitting it into the other person's court. And that's what the Democratic and Republican Party have been doing since specifically since Bill Clinton was president, where right before him you had Ronald Reagan with all the right wing agenda that he couldn't fulfill, and Clinton fulfilled them, whether it was immigration, whether it was crime bill, whether it was funding for the Pentagon, whether it was the death penalty, increasing expanding the death penalty, whether it was enriching Wall Street as opposed to Main Street. You know, the Democratic Party's shift from Main Street to Wall Street. And then even Newt Gingrich, if you don't believe that, Newt Gingrich himself said that Ronald Reagan prepared us ideologically for the dismantling of the welfare state, and Bill Clinton fulfilled it. So since then, we've had this kind of thing. And remember also, people forget now that Bill Clinton was the one that established the immigration bill that is being built on, has been built on by alternatively Republican and Democratic regimes, basically, since then. And you know, you had the people forgot that building on that, you know, that's how Obama used that those kinds of laws to earn the name of deporter in chief. By the way, he deported more people, Obama did, than Trump did. I'm not championing Trump here, but I'm just criticizing the hypocrites that are saying that there is a lesser evil. But actually, Obama, he actually deported many more people, and Biden did, than Trump did during his regime, his last regime, basically. So that's what we have, a situation of that's been carried through now through Biden, and right now we get here to this point. But I wanted to share with you a clip here that was the where the Lebanese journalist had traveled through South Lebanon, because now we're hearing about South Lebanon. And in case you're curious, I want to tell you one last thing before we move to the clip, but that there, what's happening right now, the ceasefire agreement has been extended until the 18th of this month, until next week. So to let, and that has actually deliberately allowed Israel to stay longer, actually, on certain villages in South Lebanon, which they have been, where they have been bulldozing, destroying these villages, and making the most of their time in the in this last week of the ceasefire. And of course, we've heard of the huge marches, not just in Gaza, but also to South Lebanon, to South Lebanon, where the people marched unarmed into these villages and reclaimed them. And this is would be the topic of our segment today. So let's have a listen.
Good day, this is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you from Athens, Greece on January 29th, 2025 with our frequent guest and friend and geopolitical analyst extraordinaire, Laith Maruf. Thank you so much for joining us again today, Laith.
Good to be with you, Dimitri.
So Laith, I've been very much looking forward to hearing about what you've seen and done and heard over the last several days, really, I think, historic days in Lebanon and in Palestine. But before we get into events in South Lebanon, I just wanted to set the stage for our audience members who may not be entirely up to speed on the context. So on November 27th, Lebanon entered into a ceasefire with the Israelis, or the genocidal entity, more accurately. And it was to last 60 days. And the 60 days ended, I believe, on Sunday. So why don't you start by telling us in summary form or as much detail as you care to use, what were the parties required to do under this ceasefire agreement and what in fact did they do?
Yeah, so the ceasefire agreement, in it was supposed to be that in those 60 days, Hezbollah withdraws from the south of the Litani, the Israeli military withdraws from Lebanese territory it occupies, and the Lebanese military and the UNIFIL would enter the southern Litani and position themselves in their bases there. So, you know, obviously the resistance did withdraw from the south of the Litani, but what we saw is that actually the Israeli expanded their occupation prior to the ceasefire. They had not occupied villages, they were just occupying a few open fields. And what they did instead is that they expanded their occupation and went on a rampage of destruction of all the villages that withstood their initial attack, 60-somewhat days of war. And the Lebanese military just sat down and, on the side and watched as that happened. And similarly, the UNIFIL didn't deliver on its obligations. And so the those 60-day ceasefire ended, as you mentioned, on Sunday, and the Lebanese civilians that are residents of the frontline villages decided to enact their right to return, since the Lebanese military and Lebanese government and the UNIFIL didn't deliver on their duties. And so we saw these masses of unarmed civilians just pushing through to their villages, with the Lebanese military, for the most part, trying to block them, not allowing them to go in with their cars. And people just walked into their villages and with their bare flesh liberated tens of villages from the Naqoura to Khiyam area. So it was a coincided also, by the way, with the mass return of the Palestinians in Gaza and the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. So the images both from South Lebanon and Gaza and the hypocrisy that we saw being portrayed in the commemorations of the Auschwitz liberation, I think combined to create a historic moment that is now etched in the minds of humanity.
So just to clarify for people, the Litani is a river that runs across South Lebanon. I believe it's approximately, I mean, the distance from the border of Palestine varies, but it's around 20 kilometers or so. Is that correct, Laith?
Yes. So that's the, you know, the furthest point from the border. In some points of the border, it's very close. But otherwise, yes, it's around the 20 kilometers buffer.
Right. So I just wanted to add your very astute observation about the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz coinciding with these extraordinary events in Lebanon and Gaza. The collective West did not invite the representatives of the liberating country. Auschwitz was liberated by the Soviet Red Army. And rather than ask the Russian Federation to be present at the Auschwitz anniversary commemoration, they rejected their presence and in fact had people from the far right of the Zelensky regime, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct, Laith?
Yes, and representatives from the Zionist regime in the Zionist colony. Obviously, Zelensky himself is a Zionist and a Nazi, it seems like, and yeah, his government is both. The levels of hypocrisy that exists right now in the West and the elites of the West and the media of the West is I think, mind-boggling. They've lost the plot completely. The rest of humanity, any influence that the Western elite and the Western media had on is gone. And the more these elites and this media in the West are flagrant in their persistence on being unique, and their persistence on ruining the memories of humanity and usurping history and destroying memory of things like the liberation of Auschwitz and the sacrifices that the Soviet peoples gave to liberate Auschwitz, the more they lose control of any influence on the rest of the humanity.
I understand that a number of these villagers, unarmed villagers, were killed by the genocidal entity's forces over the last few days. What exactly happened there, and how many casualties were sustained?
Yeah, so the first day of the marches to return to the villages in the south of Lebanon, the Israelis targeted the civilians in multiple villages. And on the first day, it was 18 martyrs, 100 and somewhat injured. The second day had less martyrs and injured because the Israelis really ran away from most of the villages and only stayed in the villages that are on the slopes of the Golan Heights, the Syrian Golan Heights that are occupied. So basically in the eastern sector of the border zone. We watched us and our teams down as we were filming these civilians being targeted. We saw a man that was disabled on crutches being shot near us, and he was martyred. We saw, of course, many images of heroic, courageous civilians, including women and children, facing off with Israeli tanks with their bare flesh and chasing away these occupiers. And we saw these images of cowardice from both the UNIFIL and the Lebanese military, although in some occasions the Lebanese military, under pressure of the residents and the shame that was setting in the minds of these soldiers that not moving with the civilians was putting the civilians in greater risk, we saw some of these soldiers and officers refuse, it seems, orders and actually move in either in front of the crowds or behind them as they entered the villages. So the stability of the Lebanese army and its servitude to the American embassy, who pays half of the salaries of the Lebanese military, has been shaken. The newly elected president, General Joseph Aoun, who used to head the military, and the newly appointed prime minister, who headed the International Court of Justice, have had to deal with their first test, real test. Are they going to protect the nation and its territory and its population? So I think the Americans were, surprised to see how courageous the people of Lebanon, and how the effects of these civilians taking it upon themselves to liberate their own homes would weaken all the influence they had over the Lebanese political class that is collaborating with them. One other thing that I would say is important to mention is that the Israelis violated the ceasefire almost 1,400 times since it began. And yesterday, the Israeli military conducted multiple air raids, hitting Nabatiya city that we visited together a few months ago, Dimitri. And also they hit this morning Kherbet Selem, which we also visited close to the border. So Nabatiya is somewhere like past the Litania River, so it's more than 20 kilometers away. And the Kherbet Selem is right on the border. But we've had injuries because of these attacks in Nabatiya. Last night, 24 people were injured. Today in Kherbet Selem, there was two martyrs and four injured people. So the violations continue, of the ceasefire and the crimes of the Israelis continue. This is now, we know that the government of Lebanon, supposedly the new government, sent in a complaint. This is all they can do to the United Nations Security Council. And the Americans attempted to force the government to accept an expansion or an extension of the ceasefire till the February 27th, which would have coincided with the end of the ceasefire in Gaza. But the government, under pressure of both the civilians and the political parties, rejected this demand by the Americans. Now the Americans are demanding that it's extended to the 16th of February. And I don't think the resistance and the population in the South will accept that. So we'll see how the government deals with the situation now.
And where are the Israeli forces in Lebanon at this moment?
At this moment, they're only situated in, four or five different villages that are very close to the slopes of the Golan Heights, all the way in the eastern sector of the border. Much of everything else, they've abandoned their posts and their occupation posts and left. But as I said, they're still bombarding some of these villages that were liberated yesterday and the day before.
And of the villages south of the Litani that you entered, that you were able to access, I mean, which ones in the last few days were you able to access, and what was the level of destruction that you witnessed there?
Look, I spent 3 days going to much of all the villages in the south, from the coast to the eastern sector. And, me and you, we've been to, a lot of these war zones. But I don't think I was prepared mentally for the destruction levels and the images that we saw. It was total destruction. Most of these villages are wiped out completely. And beyond having to see people being martyred right beside us, which is, not something that you wish on anybody, even when in journalist field, there was these images of, families digging through their homes to try to find their loved ones. And we saw multiple decomposed bodies and skeletons being pulled out by the returning families. Of course, it was sad moments. And there was one very uplifting moment, which was a young man in his early 20s, a fighter from Hezbollah, that actually came out from under the rubble in one of these villages that were occupied for over 2 months by the Israelis. And he was there on the front line during the whole 60-some-odd days of the battle on the ground. So this man survived for 4 months, cut off from the world, and he came out covered in dust, obviously malnutrition and weakened, and was carried by the crowds, and taken to the hospital. But this shows you, what kind of fighters these people are. This is their land. They are willing to stay under rubble, under occupation, to fight the Zionists, because it's their land. They have this connection to it. So it was an uplifting moment. But as we speak, some of these villages since yesterday have pulled up to 18 different martyrs, like Khirbet Sinem, that was just attacked this morning, and others. They've been pulling tens of martyrs. So we, it's a bittersweet moment. It's also a reaffirmation of the Lebanese peoples and the people of the south of Lebanon, their courage, their perseverance under these conditions.
Mm-hmm. It's odd, Laith. I'm trying to understand the mentality of the, you never find it easy to navigate the mind of a psychopath, but I'm trying to understand here the mentality of the leadership of Israel, what they think they're going to accomplish by extending their presence in South Lebanon by 2 weeks or 4 weeks. It isn't going to change the reality on the ground. It's going to become, if their intention is simply to stay permanently, that'll become quickly apparent. I don't know what they're thinking here. Do you think there's any kind of plan that, in terms of their presence in South Lebanon? Do you think they ultimately intend to go? Do you think they're simply flailing and they have no idea what they want to do? I mean, what's your take on this?
Look, I think the Zionist strategists, and whether it's inside the colony or globally, have been unable to find strategies and tactics that can achieve their goals. And thus, they have abandoned strategy in general, except for their belief that genocide, ethnic cleansing, and mass destruction is their path forward to dominance over the indigenous people. And because everything else, they've been unable to achieve their goals. And look, the Israelis today made a statement that they will be only leaving if the Lebanese military and the UNIFIL fills the gap in the south. Well, you know, that's not going to happen because the Israelis are not letting them happen, right? And maybe this is going to only actually increase the pressure on the Lebanese army. If the Israelis are saying, hey, if the Lebanese military enters, we're leaving, well, tomorrow there will be old ladies from the south of Lebanon slapping around these, cowardice soldiers and marching them in front of them to enter these villages. Let's see if the Israelis withdraw. This is a reality that's actually going to happen. It's only increasing the pressure on the Lebanese army to act like a sovereign army. And that's not what the Americans want. The Americans want the Lebanese military to be captured agents. Yesterday, for instance, this Lebanese military entered a bunker manufacturing site in the Nabatiya region of Hezbollah that was abandoned by Hezbollah. And then they put out videos of this, underground facility. And then they blew up the equipment themselves. This facility survived the war, although, you know, Hezbollah had emptied it from any significant equipment and or strategic weapons. And then a few minutes after the Lebanese military announced its entry to this facility and released all these videos and destroyed whatever little equipment that there was in it, the Israelis went and bombed that same site. So the Lebanese military is acting in ways that undermines itself. And if the new Lebanese government is trying to tell Hezbollah or convince the Lebanese population that if you withdraw, we will provide security, well, they've been failing miserably, and in fact, only acting in ways that undermines security of Lebanon. I mean, the Lebanese military could have taken this facility itself and made it its own bunker and started putting its soldiers there or strategic equipment there. But no, they announced it to allow the Israelis to destroy the facility, and they destroyed whatever little weapons or equipment that there was there. So the more the Lebanese military and the new government acts in servile ways to the Zionists, the better it is actually for the resistance and the strengthening of its position.
Let's talk about Gaza, Leith. You know, I must confess that I was overwhelmed by the images of tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians returning to the north. I watched one video after another of these families, many of them torn apart for months, reuniting, declaring with every fiber of their being that they would not be forced from their land, reciting revolutionary poetry, singing It was quite a sight. I'm curious to know, you as a Palestinian, after 15 months of genocide, what impact that had upon you.
That image of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians just marching back to the north of Gaza is, what can I say? I will never forget it. Obviously, it's not only me as a Palestinian that will never forget this image. It was like the salt march almost of India, of the Gandhi time, seeing these images. And you saw how the Israelis ran away from the Nasserim crossing. And they also appointed Emiratis and Egyptians to search people or cars as they're going. But the Emiratis and Egyptians had to abandon their also posts. We saw people getting on boats coming from all the south of Gaza to the north. Those images of the old Mercedeses that are packed with unimaginable amount of people and stuff just going through the dirt. I mean, Mercedes should probably pay the people in Gaza for this advertisement. You know, those images of people digging out their loved ones, the remains, and the mass graves that are coming out, all are heartbreaking. And, you know, so the emotion is very conflicted in our hearts here, whether it's in the south of Lebanon or watching what's happening in Gaza. And you know, one moment you're joyous, and another moment you are at the edge of tears, and if not already crying, you know, seeing these images. And the amount of destruction, I mean, like, this is 100,000 tons of explosives thrown on this extermination camp in a span of 15 months. The levels of destruction we have not seen since World War II. So the Israelis, you know, must be freaked out at the failures. You know, after all of this, after this mass genocide, after all this mass destruction, the Palestinians are still steadfast. I mean, look, the Israelis, their declared goals for this war was, one, the destruction of Hamas and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza, two, the breaking of the will of the Palestinian people, and three, the mass expulsion of the Palestinians from Gaza. And all those three goals failed. They didn't achieve any of those. In fact, the resistance right now is stronger than it was before the genocide started. We saw those images of the release of the Israeli soldiers, how much coordination and administrative and structural coordination it needed. That means that Hamas and the other Palestinian factions are not only their military wings have survived this, but their administrative, their media, their coordination, everything is in full capacity. And the fact that the Ministry of Internal was able to spread out its police and its firefighters and crews of their water and electricity within minutes of the ceasefire coming into effect, that shows you that the whole governmental structures inside Gaza are still intact. So total failure for the Israelis. And the Palestinians achieved their declared goals of October 7th. That's the flood. The declared goal for it was that Palestinians were to capture Israeli soldiers and Israeli colonizers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners of war that are stuck in the Israeli dungeons for decades. And what did we see? That is exactly what happened. The Palestinians right now, there's going to be thousands of Palestinians released over the next few days and weeks in exchange for these Israeli prisoners of war. And thus, the Palestinians achieved their goal, and the Israelis achieved zero of their objectives.
Mm-hmm. I'm having difficulty believing, and I wouldn't have said this 2 weeks ago, that Israel is going to resume this genocide. I certainly think there will be more attacks on Gaza. And unless and until these war criminals are held to account, the Palestinians will always be subject to the extreme violence of this regime, as will, sadly, the people of Lebanon and Syria and other countries in the region. They have to be held to account. But I can't help but feel, Laith, that all of these developments, and I think particularly Daniel Levy, you know, a former advisor to the Israeli government, was commenting on this in an interview with Middle East High, that, you know, the Israeli public heard so much, so often about the hostages, they were literally residing the hostages in their minds. And so they were fixated on the images in Gaza when they were released. And to see all of these fighters from Hamas, you know, neatly attired uniforms, some of them apparently carrying advanced Israeli Tavor rifles, four Israeli soldiers, the Times of Israel said they seemed to be in good health, and they were smiling and waving on a podium. And behind them, there was this banner, this massive banner that said, Gaza is the graveyard of the criminal Zionists. I can't imagine that this did not have an earth-shattering impact on the psyche of the average Israeli. And now they're, with each passing day, becoming accustomed to a degree of normality in their day-to-day lives. You know, the sirens aren't going off. They aren't running into the shelters, worrying about a drone coming in from Yemen. There's going to be, I would imagine, immense pressure for the government not to return to war, certainly until the completion of the second phase of the ceasefire, which they would have to see through to completion to get back all of the prisoners of war. That's the way they've structured this deal with Hamas. What is your feeling about the likelihood of a resumption of the genocide now in light of what has happened? Of course, we don't have a crystal ball. This is nothing more than educated guesswork, but I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I am of the opinion that this war is not over. That at any moment, we don't know what's the trigger, when is the Israelis gonna decide that they wanna resume their genocide and destruction of the region. But because of their failures, if there is a real cessation of hostilities for a prolonged period, all their, the chickens will come to roost. The effects of their reputation damage will start setting in. Until now, although we can see all those campaigns to, arrest and or jail any Zionists that have been involved in this genocide are active around the world, this is still not in full force. You know, people are still busy with trying to rescue the Palestinian and Lebanese civilians that have been hurt and or try to minimize the damage. But the minute that there's actual cessation of hostilities for a prolonged period, all these campaigns to isolate the Zionist colony to and cut all relations with it and trade and so forth, and the attempts to arrest these soldiers and politicians that were involved in this genocide will go on to full speed. And therefore, I don't think the Israelis will allow that to happen. And so, because there's no return for Israel. Whatever was there in terms of minimum legitimacy that the Israeli state had as a colony before in minds of the majority of humans doesn't exist now. There's nobody that wants to do business with Israel. And in fact, we can clearly 100% say that Israel was defeated militarily, that if at any moment the imperialist coalition stops one of its supply lines, whether it's militarily or economically or media, the Zionist colony will collapse. It cannot exist without 100% effort by all the components of the empire to maintain it. Now, we take a step back and we look at how the masses of Palestinians and the masses of Lebanese people are pushed to go back to their destroyed villages and towns, still under fire, because, by the way, they are bombing Gaza right now as we're speaking. They did bomb a few towns in the north of Gaza as the civilians were returning, as they're doing here in Lebanon. But to see the Palestinian and the Lebanese people so attached to their land as indigenous people that they would go back under these conditions in rubble and just put a tent or a flag and just, you know, reside in their homes, we can compare that to what the Israeli colonists are doing. The Israeli colonists in the north of occupied Palestine, on the border with Lebanon, and those who are in the quote-unquote envelope of the Gaza extermination camp, both of them are refusing to go back to their towns and villages, although there's no more missiles falling on them. There's no threat to their life. But you see, the difference between the Palestinian and Lebanese indigenous people and that of the colonizer in terms of their relationship to the land is that here, the Palestinian and the Lebanese people, they have a historical relation, their family, they grew up, you know, they have a love for their land. The colonizer, the social contract between them and the colony is their right to loot, to kill, to rape, and, you know, enrich themselves off the indigenous land and the indigenous people under full safety, guarantee that they have the upper hand over the indigenous. Now, because Israel clearly cannot provide that upper hand anymore and the safety umbrella for the colonists to commit crimes, those colonists in the north of Palestine and in the south of Palestine are not returning because that social contract is broken. And therefore, we can already predict, you know, where this is going to go. The Israelis are going to have to somehow convince their colonists that they are safe to be bandits again, and they can't do that.
This brings us to the inestimable Donald Trump. As I'm sure you know, Laith, a few days ago, the Donald began to publicly pontificate on Air Force One about forcing 1.5 million Gazans to take up new shiny homes in the lands of Egypt and Jordan. And he purported to be able to persuade the dictator Sisi and the autocrat Hussein to accept these hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who, based upon what we've seen with our own eyes, have absolutely no interest whatsoever in leaving their land. The governments of Egypt and Jordan came out very quickly and rejected this. And we all know that the Blinken-Biden administration was trying for months to apply the same pressure on them. Do you think the Donald has any realistic prospect of persuading them to take 1.5 million Palestinians from their land?
I think it's an impossibility. The Palestinian people in Gaza would rather die, perish on their own homeland than being expelled. And obviously, Trump is desperate to appease the Zionist donors that funded his campaign. I mean, he went as far as calling Indonesia also to take the Palestinian refugees. And then he called Albania to do the same. And he got the same answer from Indonesia and Albania. These are two countries that are even more captured than Jordan and Egypt as servile to the Western. But even that reply from the president of Albania, who's a freak, that works with the MEK, the Mujahideen Khalq, that terrorist that attack Iran all the time, even him was very blunt in his reply to Trump. So there's no way that anybody will accept what Trump is proposing, neither the Palestinians nor any of the vassals that the United States could put pressure on to accept. The other thing that we should note here is that there was one truthful thing that Trump said, and that is the number of 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, which is an indication that actually 800,000 Palestinians perished in those 15 months, either through direct military attacks and or through malnutrition, medical neglect, and what have you. So we will start right now getting a clearer image of the size, the shocking number of loss of life in Gaza. And I am not, you know, I don't know what to say more than this. Auschwitz is now buried in Gaza. The memory of the Holocaust will be buried in the sands of Gaza. The Jewish people have ruined, by not standing up to the Zionists amongst them, have ruined the memory of the millions that perished in the Holocaust, and there's no going back from that. I don't think anybody would watch even a Holocaust movie if it's aired today, because it's so repulsive now, the idea to think about the Holocaust when we saw a fresh Holocaust being conducted by those who claim to commemorate the Holocaust conducted by the Nazis.
Now, you have people on the ground, Laith, in, when I say you, I mean Free Palestine TV, in the West Bank as well. And the genocidal entity escalated its barbarism in the occupied West Bank almost immediately upon agreeing to the ceasefire in Gaza. Can you tell us what's going on there, and particularly in Jenin and Tulkarm?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems that the Israelis, once they have failed in Gaza, they wanted to try their luck in the West Bank. And we have the collaborative Abbas regime that has been working with them to try to suppress the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank. We saw invasion of Jenin and Jenin refugee camp over the last week, with battles, ongoing battles still till today inside Jenin and Jenin refugee camp, and the Palestinian non-authority security forces arresting and humiliating and beating a few fighters from Jenin as they escaped the slaughter. This is now shaking the whole West Bank. Those images of the humiliation and abuse of Palestinian youth at the hands of the Palestinian non-authority security forces have really, really put the situation on the edge. And we saw as a similar attacks by the Zionists and the Palestinian security forces, quote unquote, on Tul Kerem, coordinated attacks. And this led to a few youth that conducted a ambush for the head of the Palestinian Authority security forces in the Tul Kerem region. And they chose it purposefully in front of a stationary camera. They rammed this car and then pulled him out of the car and beat the hell out of him, destroyed his car, whipped him, really. And so now the, you know, these officers within the Palestinian authority security forces are having to worry about their safety as they conduct collaboration and treason against the Palestinian people. And that's what it should be. Now, there's a lot of homes that have been destroyed in both the Tul Kerem and Jenin. There's also now an expanding attack on Nablus. And it seems like the Israelis are going to try to do it all across the West Bank. This is also coinciding with the release of Palestinian prisoners of war. And by the way, if I don't know if some of your viewers saw this, but the images of the arrival of these emaciated, abused Palestinian prisoners as they arrived into Ramallah with the crowds chanting for Palestinian resistance groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and flying their flags, and then the Palestinian Authority security forces having scuffles and fights with the Palestinians to try to bring down the flags of the Palestinian resistance, and then trying to fly Fatah flags. This was all indications of how Abbas has lost any control of the situation. And he can't provide the services he's asked to provide. He tries, but it's now his maneuverability and his ability to deliver on anything that the Israelis and the Americans want it's decreasing by the day. And finally, we saw also at that moment how the Palestinian authority, if there is an election in Palestine, and there hasn't been one since 2006 when Abbas was gonna lose everything, Fatah and Mahmoud Abbas wouldn't be able to win one seat.
Mm-hmm. I think you would agree with me, Laith, that there's been much discussion about who's going to govern Gaza when this horror is finally brought to an end. And of course, the Israelis, I think, would be very happy to see Abbas and his collaborationist troops assume power there. I assume you would agree with me that this is yet another demonstration of delusional thinking. The idea that the Palestinian Authority could control the population of Gaza, as it is barely doing in the West Bank now, where it has been entrenched for some time, is a fantasy. I mean, would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, like those images of the whipping of that PA security sergeant in Tul Kerem would look like child's play if the PA security forces attempted to enter Gaza. They will be actually assassinated, liquidated, killed in the open. They'll be probably hung in the squares if they attempt to enter Gaza. And that's what they the treatment they should receive naturally as collaborators. So, we saw how the French treated the Vichy regime collaborators and even the prostitutes that slept with German soldiers to entertain them, so we don't expect the Palestinians to do anything less to the collaborators from the Mahmoud Abbas regime if they attempt to enter Gaza on behalf of the Israelis. I want to say one thing that I forgot when we were talking about the West Bank. The journalists in the West Bank right now are coming under intense pressure and attacks and by both the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority. Amongst them is the journalist of Free Palestine TV, our youth that we've been training to produce this content. 2 days ago, one of our journalists in Tul Kerem came under fire along with a host of other journalists that were with her. Luckily, she survived. But this is, over the last, 3-4 months, four of our journalists were abducted, arrested, held with no charges by both the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli authorities. And, so what we saw in Gaza of 200 somewhat journalists being assassinated and killed and martyred by the Israeli forces, this is going to begin to be also happening more often in the West Bank as the Israelis attempt to conduct a similar campaign as they did of genocide and expulsion and destruction in Gaza to do it in the West Bank. The importance of this work of journalism and this amazing youth that, by the way, also again on Free Palestine TV, they've interviewed the largest amount of prisoners released in this exchange in comparison to any.
So that was a clip that updates you on what's happening on the return of civilians, both to Gaza and in Lebanon. And we'll see you next week at 2 p.m. On Wednesday for the Shayunana show, which is on every Wednesday. And we'll be continuing to talk about, of course, Gaza and what's happening in Lebanon and Trump's plans for the Middle East.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Trump yesterday declared that the United States should take over Gaza. Speaking alongside Benjamin Netanyahu at a joint press conference, Trump said the U.S. would establish long-term ownership of the Palestinian territory and turn it into, quote, the Riviera of the Middle East, close quote. Trump also reiterated his call for all of Palestinians from Gaza to be displaced to neighboring countries. Asked whether U.S. troops might be sent to help secure Gaza, he said, quote, we'll do what is necessary. If it's necessary, we'll do that, close quote. While Netanyahu praised Trump for his, quote, willingness to think outside the box with fresh ideas, close quote, and in Israel, far-right leaders applauded the scheme, condemnation of the plan was swift in the U.S. and abroad. Arab leaders have already refused calls to take in Palestinians forcibly removed from Gaza, and Saudi Arabia reiterated it will not establish ties with Israel without the creation of a Palestinian state. Here in the U.S., Senator Chris Van Hollen and Representative Rashida Tlaib, both Democrats, described the idea as ethnic cleansing, with Tlaib writing on social media, quote, Palestinians aren't going anywhere, close quote. And on X, Senator Chris Murphy put it this way, quote, he's totally lost it. A U.S. invasion of Gaza would lead to the slaughter of thousands of U.S. troops and decades of war in the Middle East. It's like a bad, sick joke, close quote. In other news, a second federal judge today moved to block President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. The preliminary injunction issued by Maryland Judge Deborah L. Boardman applies nationally and is more permanent than the 14-day temporary restraining order by a federal judge in Seattle that expires tomorrow. U.S. District Judge Deborah Boardman, an appointment of President Biden, argued that citizenship is a national concern that demands a national policy. Her ruling will last through appeal. In today's hearing, Boardman said the order, quote, conflicts with the plain language of the 14th Amendment, contradicts 125-year-old binding Supreme Court precedent, and runs counter to our nation's 250-year history of citizenship by birth, close quote. The case in Maryland was brought by two immigrant rights organizations and five anonymous expecting mothers without permanent legal status. In more news, the Trump administration is putting the Committee for International Development on administrative leave. A new directive sent to all USAID staff globally and posted online stated that the workers must go on leave by Friday at 11:59 p.m. The note ended with, "Thank you for your service." The agency provides humanitarian aid to more than 100 countries and employs 10,000 people. The campaign to overhaul and potentially abolish USAID has been led by billionaire Elon Musk, who is advising Trump on his effort to shrink the federal government. And the Trump administration has started to send migrants